Hello, thank you so much, and a pleasure to be on here. Thank you so much for the invitation. Yeah, it's a sunny day here in California, and I've been pondering, when I hear these wonderful stories, people tell us that the world is held together with atoms, muons, and gluons, and quarks, and all of these things that the scientists tell us hold the world together. And indeed, that must be true. But it also strikes me that the world is held together with stories, and that's how we get to meet one another. And this story that I want to tell you today is a story that how I got led to this particular book. A number of images that's inspired me and shocked me, and how they all came together to lead me towards a story that I think is one of the most powerful for me that I have ever experienced. So a lot of you out there will know the photograph that I refer to when I say that in August 2014, the world had its collective soul sort of shook out when there was a picture, and actually a video and a series of pictures that ricocheted around the internet of a young American journalist by the name of Jim Foley, sitting in the desert, kneeling in the desert in Syria in an orange jumpsuit. Beside him, a man in a black balaclava holding a knife. We need not say too much more about that particular image because we all know that what happened afterwards. But on the same day, after my inbox was flooded with this particular image, and everyone's inbox was flooded with this particular image, some friends of mine started to send me another file, and they referred to it as a picture of Jim Foley, and I didn't want to open it. Eventually, it happened a few different times, and they'd been casting around on the internet, trying to figure out the life of Jim Foley, and they were all in shock. And they sent me a photograph of him in a bunker, in a military bunker somewhere. I wasn't sure where. And I looked closely at the image, and he was alive and happy. And when I looked at the image, I saw that he was reading a book that I had written called "Let the Great World Spin." Well, you can imagine what that felt like. I'm going to try to share my screen and see if I can get that particular image up on the screen. I'm not sure if I will or not. That's not the photo I wanted you to see. This is the photo I wanted you to see, and I hope that actually works. But that's a photo of Jim in a bunker in eventually what was Afghanistan, and he was reading my book. Now, you can imagine how I felt trying to balance these two images, and I lived with it for quite a while. And I printed the photograph out, and I put it on my office door, and I sort of said hello to Jim, for a few months, and tried to figure out how could I reconcile this image in my own heart. And what happened was that I decided to write to his mother, who I'd seen on TV, and I wrote her a long email saying that if ever she wanted somebody to write about her son, or if ever she wanted somebody to write about her herself, I would be glad to chat with her. I never heard from her. As it turned out, she actually never got the email. And a few more months went by, and I saw in the New York Times that she had got a contract to write her own memoir. And I thought, okay, great, leave well enough alone. I'm very happy that she's going to get a chance to tell her story. She wants to tell her story and the story of her son. Fast forward another 6 years, and I have written a book called A Paragon, which is set actually in the Middle East. And every day in writing this book, A Paragon, I have actually consulted with Jim Foley in the photograph, and looking to him for inspiration, for guidance, for a sense that I could pull this story together. And in many ways, I was writing the story for somebody like him. And I wrote the book, and it got published. And then the pandemic came along, and I started doing stuff online. And one of these things was a Zoom with Marquette University. Marquette University is in Wisconsin, which was the alma mater for Jim Foley. And they said to me, by the way, did you know that there's a photograph of Jim reading your novel that we use here at the school? And I said, I did. And then they said to me, by the way, Jim's mother, Diane, is actually on this phone call. So I chatted to her for a moment. And, you know, it's one of those moments when the oxygen is taken out of the air. You get your rib cage yanked open and your heart gets turned backwards. And I had a little chat with her. And then I called her again after that. And she told me that she had never been able to write her book. It was one of her great sorrows that she hadn't had a chance to write her book. She just couldn't put the words down. And so I, you know, sometimes I think I like to fancy myself as a bit of a story whisperer. Like I can get people to tell their stories also to put a structure on them. Because the hardest thing for a writer, of course, is to find a proper structure into which to contain your story. In fact, Samuel Beckett, the Irish writer, said, it is the job of the artist now to find a form that accommodates the mess. And so I got in my car. I live in New York. I drove up to New Hampshire, where she's living, and I sat with her and her husband, John, for the next 2 days, and I tried to inspire her to tell her own story. However, at the end of the first day, she told me something that sort of blew my mind. She said that two of the men who had killed her son had been arrested in northern Syria. They were known as the Beatles because they were all from, they were from London. They had Cockney accents and they'd sort of become famous or infamous a gang that kidnapped and tortured and murdered. Jihadi Johnny had been killed in a drone strike. Two of the others had been captured. They were stripped of their British citizenship. They were brought over to the United States and brought into the court system in Virginia. One of the things that Diane insisted on is that they would not be given the death penalty. And so these men took two different paths. One of them went to trial and eventually got a life sentence for everything that he'd done. The other one, Alexander Cote, pled guilty. And part of his plea agreement was that he would talk to the victims or the families of victims. So Diane said to me that she was going to go down to Virginia and talk with her son's killer. And her husband, John, didn't want to go. And her children didn't want to go, naturally. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to do. This whole prospect is strange and very hard for a lot of us to comprehend. But I wanted to be beside her as a family friend also someone who could lend her support. And also, of course, I was fascinated as a journalist and a novelist. And we went down about 6 months later to Virginia, and she walked into that courthouse. Right into the, through all these rooms and metal detectors and all sorts of things, into this big echoing room with no windows. When we walked in, there were FBI agents, there were court clerks, there were defense team members, prosecutors, a lot of people in the room. And I walked with her across the room, and there sitting at the table was Alexander Cote. He was in his prison jumpsuit. He had shackles on his ankles, and he had a book and a coffee cup in front of him. And Diane went over and she sat down beside him and she said, "Hi, Alexander. It is nice to meet you." And from that moment, I have to say, everything disappeared. everybody else in that room, even myself, I felt like I disappeared as I watched this woman talk with her son's killer. They talked eventually for 3 days, a total of 3 days. And it was truly extraordinary. I got to see compassion. I got to see forgiveness. I got to see anger. I got to see hurt. I got to see confusion. All the human emotions that were there, the human heart in conflict with itself, as Faulkner would say. And this woman, Diane Foley, in front of my eyes, became one of the most courageous people that I have ever come across. At the end, and I don't mind giving away the end of the story because, you know, it's really the process of getting towards the end that is really fascinating. At the end of our 3 days together, Diane stood up and she hadn't, we'd been, it was during COVID and we'd been more 6 feet and then 4 feet, more than 4 feet away for a lot of the time. And she turned to go and she said goodbye and she said, you know, God be with you. They talked a lot about faith and God. And then she turned and she walked across the room and everyone froze. It's like, you know, she was walking towards her son's killer and she reached out her hand. And because of his faith, he was not allowed to touch the hand of anybody who's not his mother, his sister, or his children. He wasn't allowed to touch another woman. But he did. He reached out his hand. He shook her hand. And the room was held in absolute silence and aspic at this particular moment. And then Diane turned to leave, and I waited. And because I'd established a little bit of a bond with him, and I said, "Why did you do that when you knew that it was against the tenets of your religion?" And he just put his head down and he said, "She's like a mother to us all," which was a beautiful phrase, but also a way to you know, not make himself feel guilty for having shaken these tenets in any way. But it was. It was an extraordinary moment. I felt like that all of us had flown into the window panes of our lives and just sat there stunned, and looking down and trying to pick up, you know, the various pieces of who we happen to be. It was much later that I found out that actually this photograph that had been taken of Jim Foley was taken in Afghanistan, and he was in a bunker in Afghanistan, and the guy who took the actual photograph, Jack Wilder was his name, told me that he was astounded that Jim Foley, this great young journalist, was able to sit and read a book in the middle of all the noise and clamor of Afghanistan. And you know, I think of that photograph and where it led me intellectually, where it led me emotionally, where it still leads me now when I think about this woman, Diane Foley, and the courage that she has shown. But I also look at it and I know that Jim is actually alive in the story, because death may take away a lot of things, but it does not take away our stories. And so when I look at that photograph of him, I know that he's in the permanent act of composition, and I am linked with him forever. Thank you for the chance to tell this story, and I wish you all the best.